to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm Aidy Packham, and we are putting the roof back on in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Yes, that's right. The Amex roof is in urgent need of repair after the 7,945 voices blew it off as we beat the champions Manchester City on Tuesday night. That capped a decent week for the Albion after picking up a point after drawing with West Ham on Saturday night. That means we go into this weekend's final game of the season at Arsenal, still chasing down a record Premier League's points tally and also the chance of finishing above. In other news, the club has announced this week a partnership with Scottish Premier League side Hibernian, which will see the two clubs share initiatives and player development. Whatever that means, I do not know, but we will find out, I'm sure. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back the author of From the Gutter to the Stars, Simon Medhurst, and we're also delighted to welcome back the man known as the Brighton Bard, it's Mr. Jonathan Bradshaw, and we'll also hear from Gavin Wilson from Hibs Talk. So, welcome back to the show, guys. It's lovely to see you. Basically, where do we go? I mean, obviously, have you come down from Tuesday night yet, John?
Not quite. It's been emotional. What an incredible week. My wife's been away, so it's been a sad one for me. The wine, the cat, and emotion. It's been wonderful, hasn't it?
So, did you throw the cat in the air to celebrate?
After I'd wiped up my tears, yeah. Oh, it's. The thing about when my wife is here, she's not into football much, so I get someone to explain it to and share my passion, but she's on a business trip all week. So from that aspect, it was slightly different, but that's where social media comes in. What a love in online, eh?
Absolutely. And Simon, you know, it's been a long year and a half of being locked indoors, not being able to go to football, but to have just under 8,000 people back in the Amex on Tuesday night, and to top it with that performance was just wonderful, wasn't it?
What a way to finish the home season. It was amazing. As you can tell, I've lost my voice as a result of it. I was a little bit shady just before that, but honestly, what passion. The supporters are there, as you said, blew the roof off, and what a performance from the lads in really difficult circumstances, going down, obviously, 2-0 against 10 men. Difficult situation, but boy, did they rise to it and get in the faces of obviously Man City. Yeah. And what a night. One of the best Albion experiences at the Amex so far.
Yeah, no, Al, I mean, yourself and I were both at the Amex on Saturday night as well for the West Ham game. And it was just, you know, I mean, it was a bit weird, really. I mean, having people actually in the stadium on Tuesday night again.
What they did with us is they set up the press area slightly differently. So we're all bunched around the halfway line a bit more. And I preferred it that way. It did actually make it feel like a proper press box. What didn't help my my mood there. I mean, credit to West Ham. They are a seriously improved side from the rubbish that we've seen in the past few seasons. And I've mentioned this on the show. I think that this is mostly down to the fact that they don't have their fans on their back. And they play with a bit more positivity and confidence and creativity. But what really sort of got my heckles, feckles, hackles, shackles, whatever it is up, was the two tacky Herberts from whatever publication behind me, who 10 minutes into the game decided that Declan Rice was an absolute genius running the game and pulling all the strings. And I'm thinking, he's barely touched the ball. You know, it's this lazy, lazy consideration of, right, Declan Rice, he's the top man, he's the one we've heard of, he's the one we'll write the headlines about. And, you know, there were many West Ham players who had a decent game. There was a few Brighton players that had a decent game. But, yeah, for the whole part of it, I was quite glad to see, well, A, the back of those two pillocks behind me, but two, the whole notion of, you know, the empty stadium. And we saw that, you know, the West Stand Up at the concourse have been given a lick of paint and looked a lot better for it. But it still doesn't take away from the fact that, you know, football without fans is nothing.
Actually, I thought the best player on the pitch on Saturday night was a West Ham player, but it was one that used to play for us, which was Jesse Lingard. But I mean, I had completely forgotten about his gamesmanship and the fact that he does like to moan and cry and fall over, which, I mean, let's face it, we got...
Everyone has someone who is guilty of doing that. It does cheese you off, but and it's not as though you should actually sit in acceptance of it. But for everyone you moan about, you also do have to say, well, look inside your own house as well.
Yeah. Now, John, we're gonna talk about the Man City game in a minute, but I do want to talk about something that happened in the West Ham game again, and it's something that's been causing us problems all season, basically, and it's been our game management of, we took the lead in the 84th minute, and I guess a draw probably would have been a fair result on balance, but when you go 1-0 up in at that late in the game management has got to be better, right?
It's that, yeah. 84 minutes, we went ahead too early, didn't we?
We got our equaliser in first.
Yeah, we want to score in the 91st, exactly. I guess psychologically it probably is much simpler or easier to go ahead in the first half, or perhaps better said, going ahead with 7 minutes to go probably isn't the best based on what's happened. I mean, everybody probably was thinking the same thing. And when it went in the back, when they equalised, it wasn't the most surprising thing, was it? I wonder if they must have talked about it so much this year, because the plots of so many games have just repeated themselves, haven't they? I mean, if we talk about specifics, I thought there was a foul, and I haven't watched it on replay yet, but I thought there was a foul just before we gave the ball away, and that wasn't pulled up. I thought it was going to go back to VAR. When I saw them equalise, I thought, well, I think we've got a chance of that being chalked off. It's interesting psychology. I wonder if it's obviously unsaid because I'm not going to be talking about it on the pitch, but I wonder if that sort of energy goes around the team thinking, oh no, we've now got 7 minutes to potential 3 points. That can add extra psychological pressure, can't it?
Yeah. Simon?
Yeah, no, I just really endorse that. I thought it was a foul, but when they played it back on the TV, Bobby Zamora said about Ben White, perhaps played for the foul, stayed down trying to buy the foul, when perhaps he should have got back up on his feet and blocked it. But I think that was a little bit harsh because it happened so bloody quickly. Yeah. And what a finish.
It was a great finish, but I mean, we had the chances to clear a lines long before that. In fact, there was one clearance from Yves Bissouma that, like, Cannon struck. I can't remember who it was. I think it was Pascal. But
that's not game management. Game management is when you know that you can actually keep the ball and keep, you know, the opponent out for however long it is. I'm actually sometimes a bit confused as to what the whole notion of game management is. I mean, if it's a case of, you know, stopping the other team scoring, that's not game management. That's just playing the game that you should be. I mean, it doesn't matter when you score, unless the other team doesn't have time to equalise. The fact that you could argue, okay, if West Ham scored first and then we equalised in 86 minutes, what's the game management there? Are we doing that? No, we're just trying to do our best. I mean, let's face it, if West Ham had won, it probably would have been deserved. A draw was a little bit more than I thought that we did deserve. But just because you are ahead with 6 minutes to go, it doesn't automatically follow. Mm. And also, don't forget, we also missed, and this is where we will progress in coming seasons, is that we did miss our leader on the pitch. And I felt that for a lot of that game, they did play slightly in a slightly rudderless kind of way. We didn't have our big hitters on the pitch for all the game. And when we did, it got better. And we've still got quite a lot of players who are still fairly inexperienced who have yet to learn how to close out a game against such high quality. So it's not something I'm overly worried about at the moment. Because let's face it, if you're going to talk about the notion of game management, we did it perfectly well against Manchester City. And the only difference is that they didn't score. It's nothing. And yet they probably should have done. We'll come to it, but they should have scored. You know, is that game management? Or was that the fact that Man City got, you know, were hopeless in front of goal at that time? So, you know, it's a criticism I don't think that really holds water for me. All I'd say is that, yeah, I think it was a point gained rather than two points lost.
But I mean, the point really is out the amount of points that we've lost from winning positions this season. It's the fact that we need to be. I don't like.
But being ahead doesn't mean to say you're in control of the game. It doesn't mean that at all.
Not necessarily, but I mean, I, I mean, I, I don't think you're understanding what I'm saying, to be honest, Al. But
what are you saying?
Basically, what I'm saying is that we just need to be, once we've got our noses in front, we need to be more savvy. Okay, yes, because I mean we tend to sit back and invite the pressure. What we need to be, we need our leaders on the pitch to actually take the game, take it by the scruff of the neck, keep the ball and keep the ball at the other end of the pitch. Now I know that's not going to happen in every single game, but we just need to be a little bit more streetwise when we've got ourselves in front, because we've lost so many points from leading positions this year. And you know, you don't if we'd have carried on that, we wouldn't be having the conversations about relegation that we've been having all season, and we'd be having the conversation that West Ham were having, where they're still pushing for the European places.
Yeah, but that still seems to presume that, you know, the only difference that you're talking about is that A, the way we play versus B, the way we play, whether we've scored or not. You know, there's been games where we should be pushing for a goal, and the likes of Sheffield United spring to mind, certainly in the first half, where the game we lost, and we were hopeless in the first half. In the second half, yeah, we had a lot more of the ball, but our game management was to be on the front foot. It's just that we were useless up front. So, you know, would you say the game management was the fact that we didn't actually, you know, we conceded sloppily, but that was in the 14th minute. And yet, all you have to do is reverse that and say, okay, well, if we conceded with 15 minutes to go, you know, it's not about that. It's about the whole 90 minutes. Yeah. Okay. There will be ebbs and flows, and the other team will change their style and pattern as well. And we have to adapt to that. If nothing else, the team that goes behind, especially with 6 minutes to go, is going to go a bit more gung-ho anyway.
Jonathan, you played the game at a decent level. I mean, talk us through how you would do it.
Oh, goodness me. I did, but it's 25 years ago. I'm trying to remember something. Obviously,
you've had a sleep since then.
It wasn't in the same situation, obviously, in that sense. I think... oddly enough, I don't think I've mentioned this last time you kindly invited me on. I work in psychology and behavioural science, and I think that's what fascinates me, AD, about this whole area is what's going on in the self-imposed pressure, the internal dialogue in terms of what's going on in each of the players' minds when they know there's been observation, stroke criticism of how many points we've lost from being ahead. Fair enough. You know, what's going on? You know, I don't know anything about this, but I am sure that the club have a really interesting and qualified psychologist that goes through this with the players, that talks to them about what's their internal dialogue and the self-imposed pressure. In terms of the practical sense, in terms of tactics, I agree kind of both of what you're saying. You know, game management is a much easier thing to observe with hindsight, isn't it? We didn't have game management because we've obviously perhaps, you know, lost points from a winning position. But I do agree, you know, with dumping on the pitch and other players that command. I mean, Lallana came on obviously for quite a lot, pretty much the second half, didn't he, against City? But yeah, in terms of tactics, I've always thought this, and I think it's common knowledge within football, you're most susceptible to you know, get scored against once you've just scored. And I think game management in that sense is simply keeping a clean sheet for 5 minutes. And that doesn't really matter if you've, you know, let a goal in after 5 minutes or with 5 minutes to go.
Keep it tight in the back, lads. Okay, well, let's move it. I mean, okay, I mentioned there that West Ham were aspiring for European competition. And obviously, we've just gone through this whole Super League ridiculous concept that's been going on now. A lot of the owners of that were involved in that were American owners, John. Now, so I'm just curious to see what the reaction to it was from your side of the pond, because I mean, the American sports do have this whole what's the word I'm looking for?
Franchise
thing, no relegation, and things. So I mean, it's quite commonplace over there, but from what I've seen, that there was still uproar from the States.
There was. I mean, that the night we played Chelsea, I enjoyed the watching the pack of cards fall down as much as I did our result, really. funny enough, coincidentally, I was down at a local baseball game, guys. The Tulsa Drillers. They share the stadium with FC Tulsa, the soccer stroke football team here. And it was just a few days after that. And I lots of people heard my accent, and they're always so friendly and curious, and they want to talk soccer.
You're an English.
You know the Queen.
Do I know Phil Collins at least once a week for some reason? And they were asking me, because this is anecdotal, but the knowledge about the Premier League and English football grows and grows and grows amongst the average man and woman over here, which is great to see. And I had some really interesting, learned questions about, you know, they what you just said, AD, everyone knows over here how it works. So why was there uproar? And it was quite interesting to be able to give them the story of Brighton, tell them our story. But in terms of their perception, yes, people think it's perfectly normal to buy a franchise, like Beckham has done, I suppose, buy a franchise and create a team. In fact, FC Tulsa used to be called the Tulsa Roughnecks. That's changed its name about, I think, in 2019, it was bought by new investors. That's slightly different. But in terms of the wider media, yes, there was uproar about our uproar. There was relative confusion, but because it's a different mindset, isn't it?
Mm.
It's playing without jeopardy as well.
Well, what you've got here, obviously, and I think, and we've spoken to someone who's over in Pittsburgh a few times, and she was sort of like, you know, not completely cognizant with the history of the game and how the history isn't a history that stands alone. It's how society has developed. You know, it started as a working class game. It was professional through the working classes. And yet in the early days of the FA Cup, it was played with teams from, you know, the services and from public schools and from universities and what have you. And it became professional through the working classes. And these clubs that we're talking about are 100, 120, 130 years old. I think therein lies the social dichotomy, the social difference here, John, is that, because like I say, you can buy and sell a club as you and make it your own on almost on a whim, well, provided you've got a couple of billion sort of in loose change down the back of the sofa. But here, history and culture is everything. And is that something that you say that Americans are waking up to from our point of view?
Yes, I think they are, but they have to, you've got to explain it because they literally haven't experienced it. You know, it literally is an overused word, but I mean it in its real sense here. They haven't had that. Now, I'm not knocking history. I live on Route 66. There's incredible history around here, but there's not the history linked to what you're saying, Al, which is the football history, the social history, the change in social evolution and that has, as you're quite right, it's been tied with the evolution of the game as well. So it's, you know, everybody I meet, I will give the emotional story of our club, but also point them in direction of black and white photos from, you know, the last century with the Goldstone ground and the fact it was there till relatively recently. And so many grounds in the Premier League. I know a lot have changed, but if you look at the Premier League and they're obviously the next three leagues, many people, many players are still playing on the same grounds that they were 100 years ago. So that's something literally they haven't got. And it's I certainly try and share that aspect that you alluded to with everybody I meet over here.
Yeah. Cool. Now, Simon, I mean, in your book, I mean, you talk about visiting the great stadiums of the country. And, you know, the whole Super League notion was just, you know, they were trying to take that away from us, weren't they?
Yeah, well, I'm a great, as you would know from the book, I'm a great believer in the fabric of a football club and what they do in the community. I've travelled around this country to every ground, bar a couple that have just recently been built, and I've worked with people, sponsors of football clubs, and what they do beyond football is amazing, and it gives people hope, it gives people spirit. And what happened with the ESL was basically shattering those dreams. But I believe it was inevitable that it was going to happen. You know, at the end of the day, it's a business. The Americans and whoever owns these football clubs have bought in to make a profit, and they felt they could maximize it. So you can't blame them for exploring it, but the way it was handled and the way it was announced was horrendous. I mean, most kids who play FIFA they create dream tournaments. And I guess that, in a roundabout way, was what was happening there. It was a utopia solution, but it would have made a mockery out of the fabric of football. Relegation, promotion, and as I said, what we would lose in terms of our football institutions in the UK without those top clubs committing really to what is our bread and butter.
Okay. Well, one of those clubs was one that's going to be crowned champions on this weekend, and they're also going to the Champions League final next weekend. But they still couldn't beat us, so that makes us champions of the world, in my view. And
yeah, good luck with that.
I'm going to, Simon, for you, how did you feel going back into the stadium?
It was just a dream day. I don't know if you know, but I did a bit of an article for the Times, and that was actually printed on Tuesday morning. It was about the return. So I did a piece about the return of football fans. So that was a dream in itself, being printed in the Times. Again, basically a picture of Harry Kane next to my article. My dad was in heaven, his son, and obviously his favourite player. So there was that. Then we did something different. We did a car boot party in the uni. And then when we got into the ground, we were in the away end, which gave it a unique experience. So it was just an absolutely fantastic experience. And then as we already started with, to come back from that two-goal deficit in the way that we did and the spirit that we did, and even a mild-mannered Mr. Potter managed to upset their management.
No, I mean, I know there's no direct science to prove this, but I mean, do you honestly think it going 2-0 down in an empty stadium, we would have come back from that?
No, I don't think we would have done. I think there were two things in the game where the crowd had an influence: the sending off, and I was down that end, and it was a foul, and he was the last man, so in effect, it's a sending off. But the crowd influenced that decision in terms of they got onto the ref straight away. And the other one was Foden's goal celebration, because that really wound the crowd up. I was behind that goal. He scored a worldie. We all clapped, and then he did the Billy Earl's celebration, and everyone got wound up around me. And I think we really took the game to them. And obviously, we scored pretty quickly, which always helps. Yeah. But yeah, what a comeback! And to see that fight was and the passion from the supporters, because it was just breathtaking.
I'm not sure I've ever met Billy Earls. Where's he live? A momentous night to have everyone there, and having everyone singing Sussex by the Sea was wonderful. And the team walked out. Now, and there was a telltale sign that something was about to change. And it was Dan Burnt that gave it away by being so short, clearly, because I don't know if you've noticed this, he's tall. I mean, but his tracksuit being not quite the right size for him revealed that there's a new shirt underneath, which was meant to be the big reveal, which didn't quite work with everybody.
I think there was kind of talk about it, but it's curious as to wonder why the club has done what it's done, in as much as going from stripes to plain blue to stripes again. I don't know what the thinking was, apart from the fact of, oh, it's a new kit. And so clearly, 2 years in a row, one is so totally different from the other. But that said, we did a straw poll on social media, hardly the most conclusive, but you know, it's got very, very high approval ratings, sort of like in the 80-90% sort of mark. You know, I'm sure that if we have Phil Shelley, our sponsor, on here, he'd have a total takedown or total breakdown of it. There's elements of retro to it. There's elements of progressiveness to it as well. I love the fact that there's all aspects of the shirt I really like. I take the point about the big panel at the back looking like a bib. I get that, but I don't mind that. I like the fact that the front is a V. I don't mind collars. I don't mind no collars. I like the V. In fact, Aidy, now I think about it, do you remember when you bought a shirt, a retro shirt from my shop? It was an early 60s one. And I almost saw you almost sort of like day in, day out with it in something not dissimilar from the early 60s.
Yeah, I know that it was the 1956 shirt, I think.
I think it might be a sort of 61, 62. Yeah, it might have been a second division shirt.
But it was, you know, I mean, actually, the one that really reminded me of was the 88 Spall shirt. But,
I always think Alan Kirbishley.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, quite frankly, it doesn't really. We could have been wearing clown shoes for all I care, because.
Most of the season we have.
Well, you know, I mean, the stats this year, I mean, I had a quick look at a comparison between this year and last year. And in terms of they're pretty much identical, apart from
shooting possession and.
Well, the only thing that we've up to this point, obviously, we'd played one more game last season. But last year we'd won 9, drew 14, lost 15.
Right.
This year we've won 9, drawn 14, lost 14 so far with a game to go. The only real glaring difference is the fact that the goal difference was minus 14 last year and minus 4 this year. And we scored one more goal than we had at this point last year. So,
what you're actually saying about that is that whilst nearly everything's the same, and you could argue where's the progression, it sounds like we've conceded quite a bit fewer. And in which case, you know, because let me ask John in on this one, and I don't know if it's become obvious to you. Do you think that the inclusion of Ben White is kind of has been effectively the completion of the jigsaw puzzle in defence, and that back three of Dunk, Webster and White, should it all be okay, could be a defence for quite a long time to come?
I think exactly that, Al. I think that was the jigsaw piece. And I think when all the kerfuffle was going on at the end of, you know, 12 months ago about would he stay or, you know, would he come back from Leeds, the club knew that. I think what you've outlined is what they saw. They knew how he played. It wasn't a new signing as such. And he fitted in as expected, and therefore had the impact that I suspect they expected it would, which is what AD outlines, 10, 11 fewer goals. And if we can keep all three of them, then there's at least 2 or 3 years. I mean, Dunk's not spring chicken, but, you know, the foundation of the team is that three, as you outline.
Yeah. And don't forget, Simon, we've changed our we've had a lot of injuries in defence. We've lost Tarek Lamptey. I don't really like including Solly March as a defender, but I mean, I guess we have to this year. But we've lost him, and those two were both massively important to us in the early part of the season. And when they come back next year as well, I mean, there's some major selection headaches going on there, isn't there?
Yeah, and you haven't mentioned Joel Veltman as well, who I think has been a superb addition to our squad. I totally agree with what everyone said about the piece of the jigsaw, but I think the final piece of the jigsaw for that back three was actually a major decision that Potter had to make in goal.
Yeah.
And I think Bob Sanchez is that final piece. And since he's come in, the clean sheets have increased, and obviously we have tightened right up. And I think you can see the confidence in those three.
Yeah, I mean, we've already got, I think it's 4 more clean sheets than we got the whole of last season as well at this stage.
Yeah.
But I mean, he just exudes confidence, doesn't he, John? And it's like, I don't want to be down on Matty Ryan, really, because, I mean, he's been a terrific servant for us. But since Big Bad Bob's come in, he's just been a cut above.
Well, there's players that come in at the right time for a club and leave. And it's not that they weren't good enough. You know, I mean, think of the players that have come and gone. Everyone who knows the club knows this is a long-term project, and you recruit those you can afford and have the skills for you at that moment. And then they leave. And it's not that they weren't good enough or there's criticism. It's just you need the right tools for the situation you're in. And you're quite right. A few comments as arriving in Arsenal rubbed people up the wrong way from Matty, but ultimately people are thankful and grateful and love him. But, you know, as Simon's saying, Bob's come in, Robert's come in, and Sanchez is the right tool in the right box for now. And he's proving a huge, huge asset.
Okay, well, we're going to talk a little bit more about Man City again in a minute. But first, you're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. The show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the fabulous oldfootballshirts.com. And we do have a shirt of the week for you to have a look at. Now, who wants to have a go at describing this one? Jonathan, let's go to you. What do you reckon of this one?
I think quite attractive. We were looking at a short blue collar, AD, vertical stripes around an inch wide. I'm going to say white and wine, red winey colour. Vertical on the front and horizontal on the sleeves. Umbro brand. I think it's quite attractive. I love the red wine colour. My first guess was South America. I can't tell you why, but South America was my guess.
Okay.
I think someone's mucked about with the badge, so I can't.
That would be Phil.
It was you, was it?
No, that's Phil.
It was Phil. Yeah. So you can't really identify it from the badge, but everything about the badge seems to make me think it is actually an English side. I know that there was this thing historically, certainly in the late 70s, that Sheffield United had a red and white striped shirt, but with kind of the red was outlined by black. So there's a touch of that to this, but that doesn't look like the Sheffield United badge. So given that it is maroon and white, I'm going to guess Manchester City.
Yeah, exactly where I was coming from, Anna. It's just come through, and I reckon that was the kit they wore. You know, when we had the problem with the ball boy?
Oh, Keith Cuss. In that case, can I just tell the story? Because obviously there will be people who don't know this, and it is part of Albion folklore. I think it was the game they were referring to on the telly where the last time we beat Manchester City, which was not including the League Cup game, which was in 1989. It was 2-1. I think we scored a late winner, and it was into the last minute, maybe even injury time, I don't know. But it was at the Goldstone. The ball gets knocked out of play, and it kind of just... it gets kicked up in the air a little bit, probably around about 10 feet in the air. And as it comes down, Keith Cuss, the oldest ball boy in town, rather than catching it or giving it back to the Man City player for a quick throw-in, backheads it into the crowd. The crowd, certainly the North Stand, where I was as a kid, went, "Hey!" Man City players went loopy. Now, it's nice, isn't it nice to know in an uncertain world, 22 years later, some things don't change?
There is footage of it somewhere.
Is this Man City, AD?
Of course it is. it's top trolling from Phil here. This is what he's got to say about this shirt. This is, of course, the 1988-89 away shirt of Manchester City, the former European Super League team. This is the shirt that was worn the previous time we beat them in the league, which was April the 1st, 1989.
Well played, Simon. Well played.
The citizens were the fools that day when at 1-1, City's Ian Brightwell scored an own goal to give Brighton the lead. The Seagulls eventually finished winning 2-1, and Alan Kirby scored the other goal. The game is played in front of 12,072 fans, and we finished the season 19th in Division 2. City were runners-up and promoted to Division 1. In 1989, City played at Main Road, which they moved into in 1923. By the end of their tenure, the stadium's capacity was 35,150, although the record crowd there was over 84,000 for a game against Stoke City in the FA Cup in 1934. Historically, the club had several beginnings, starting in 1880 as St Mark's, and then in 1887, Ardwick Association FC, and they were eventually formed under the guise of Man City in 1894. The light blue colour was chosen apparently as the club was supported by the local Masonic Lodge, and light blue was their colour. There's been plenty of players that worn both blue and white stripes, as well as the light blue of City. In recent years, we've had Abdul Razak, and Wayne Bridge. Going back a few years, we had Joe Corrigan had a brief spell with us. Paul Dickoff, of course. Gareth Barry spent his youth career with us. And he ended up playing at the empty hat, as Phil calls it, playing over 150 times for the former European Super League side. and Steve Coppell as well used to manage them.
Wasn't Gordon Smith at both sides as well?
Yeah, so there we go. So thanks for that, Phil.
Now, with the recent announcement from both Brighton and Hove Albion and Hibernian Football Club up in Edinburgh, the two clubs have seemed to have got together to have a close cooperation deal, mostly focusing on player development. To see how that's come across at the other end of from where we are, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by our counterparts from the Hibernian podcast. This is Gavin Wilson of Hibs Talk. Gavin, how are you?
I'm good. I'm very nervous ahead of tomorrow, as I'm sure we'll talk about, but I'm very good. Very good.
That's all right. We're always nervous ahead of every game, just in case something goes wrong. But just briefly before we start, what's happening? For those of you not just arrived from Mars, what's happening tomorrow?
So Hibs are in the Scottish Cup final for obviously the sort of big two up here, kind of known as Celtic and Rangers. They both went out. Rangers knocked out Celtic, and then Rangers went out in the semi-final. The quarterfinals to St Johnstone, and it's ourselves and St Johnstone in the final tomorrow. Hibs are in a weird situation of being favourites. I don't think I can remember a situation where we've been favourites in the Scottish Cup final anyway. But yeah, really looking forward to it. Trying to not get my hopes up too much, but at the same time, trying to, you know, be positive and think, why should we not get it done? Really excited about that.
Great stuff. We'll come back to that presently, because I mean, this actually ties in with the fact that we're recording this on the 38th anniversary of our one and only cup final appearance. So we'll come back to that. But for our listener who isn't particularly familiar with the history of Hibernian Football Club, give us the potted story of the club. You know, let people know who it is that we're jumping into bed with.
I mean, it's a tough one to know where to start, I guess. I mean, Hibs, you know, as on the chest, it's been around since 1875. And I think there was, in the past, it was to do with Irish immigrants who were setting up a football team to kind of have to give other Irish immigrants coming over something to do, and it kind of expanded from there. Obviously we've had some success in the 50s, winning the cups and things like that. A lot of games in Europe as well, especially in the 80s and 90s and stuff. Maybe not the success the likes of Aberdeen are kind of more known for. In more recent years, we've pretty much been, I'd love to say, be an established Premier League team, or Premiership team, whatever it is. But
we're all the time, don't I?
Yeah, changes all the time. But we have had two spells in the championship, one in 99 and then more recently 2014. But if honest, that's probably the best spell as a Hibs fan. We were winning games all the time, and then whilst in the championship, we went on to win the Scottish Cup, which we hadn't won in 114 years. So that was a big deal 5 years ago. It's actually 5 years ago today, 21st of May, 2016. A massive day in the club's history. So yeah, there's been lots of stuff on the socials about that today. Everyone's sort of buzzing about that and hoping to make it a double tomorrow. But yeah, I mean, we're kind of a club that obviously Celtic and Rangers in the last 30, 40 years have kind of ran away with the league all the time. So it's kind of been tough to kind of break that, which I'm sure we're going to talk about a bit more in a bit. Mm. But yeah, I mean, Hibs have been kind of always prided themselves in playing football in an attractive way, making it as much as possible about entertainment, with the exception of a couple of managers that kind of came in. One manager came in and said, if you want to be entertained, go to the cinema. So other than a couple of managers like that, it's kind of been about trying to play exciting football, bring young players through. It's been a big mantra of the club. Obviously, most notably, 2004 kind of time, we had our golden era, it was called. Scott Brown, who obviously went on to do fantastic things at Celtic. Kevin Thompson, who played at Middlesbrough as well as Rangers. Stephen Whittaker. David Murphy, although he was sort of brought in, but even then, like players like, and then Derek Riordan and O'Connor, who two very talented players, but maybe off-field issues meant they didn't reach their heights. But and obviously it's Stephen Fletcher as well, who's had a lot of success. So all those players kind of came through the one time. That was an exciting period, and there's been a real emphasis to kind of keep that youth development going since then. But yeah, that's sort of a wee spiel about Hibs, I guess.
Now, everyone who's listened to our show knows about sort of how Tony has built the Lancing Training Ground, or the Elite Performance Centre, and with a view to obviously with future proofing the Albion. And I think we're finally 5-6 years down the line getting to see the fruits of those labours. With so many, you know, we've got the highest number of Albion product, for want of a better term, people playing in the Premier League compared to any other Premier League club. So there's obviously a thing going on down here where, you know, we're finally putting out a conveyor belt of decent players. And I think that sounds like it would be something that, if that's what Hibernian are doing, then it would be something attractive for the Albion, and probably likewise for Hibernian themselves, if that's what they're doing. So tell us about the pathway system as much as you can at Hibernian. You said that, you know, 2004 was a golden period, but, you know, tell us about the 2021 class.
Yeah, so I mean, there's some exciting players coming through. The most notable one is Josh Doig, who has come through, won Young Player of the Year. Was kind of tight when I seen him play, I think a pre-season friendly, like when he just signed or when he just came through a couple of years back. He played as a centre back. Spoke to him about this in a press conference. He says, you know, he's played midfield, he's played centre back, he's played defensive midfield. He'd never really played left back before this season, and then for some reason sort of got tried out there in a couple of friendlies, done well, and has been phenomenal. A revelation at left back. Stevenson has been our left back for 12 years now or something. He's over 500 appearances and he's managed to keep Stevenson out of the team. First player to do it has been a young 18-year-old, real exciting talent. A bit no surprise that in the lead up to the cup final, the papers are having a field day linking him with Watford, apparently a 4 million bid. AC Milan today was the newest one, but I don't know if that's all just sort of cup speculation and trying to get clicks and things, but yeah, so he's the sort of the really exciting one coming through just now. A few sort of years before him, sort of 21 now, Ryan Porteous, really, you know, a centre back, came through at 17-year-old, started getting in the team at a young age, a few appearances as a 17-year-old, and then kind of got given the chance to be the starting centre back the two seasons after that. Unfortunately, like about the January, February time, both seasons kind of had season injuries, which kind of ruled him out for the rest of the season. Obviously, the last season was ended a bit sooner, and then this season he's played pretty much every game, other than sort of a spell in February when after sort of transfer speculation at the end of January. But he's been brilliant. He's a lot of people say about his temperament and things like that, but then this season he's improved on that. I think that's a good example of somebody, you know, taking advice and learning from mistakes and improving. So, you know, but yeah, so that's one of the young players coming through. There's another one that's sort of tipped for big things next season, Stephen Bradley. Really excited about him, a tricky right winger. We've only sort of seen him in brief spells this season, but apparently next season is going to be his season. So really so excited
quite,
about that.
Basically, there's quite a bit of previous at Hibernian Football Club of bringing the kids on, yeah.
Yeah, and there's been you know, like I say, we've got the big training facility. What I mentioned, that golden era earlier on. That a lot of those the money that we got from selling those players, and to be fair, some of the players they're signing on fees, they've donated back to the club. We built Hibernian Training Centre, or HTC, this brilliant facility. It's great for the kids. It's got everybody in one place. It's a state-of-the-art training facility, and they're still looking to improve it. So yeah, that's been brilliant. And like I said, they've got all the right people in the building. A good example would be, you know, about developing players as well was John McGinn. We did sign him from St Mirren. But he came in, he was a young, you know, skinny laddie, and he got the nutritionist that kind of dealt with him and told him what he should be eating in terms of bulking out, the sports, like, I don't know the titles of people, but people sort of told him what he should be doing in the gym, the analyst that watched his games back with him. Our sporting director put it perfectly. The only person that's got John McGinn to where he is John McGinn. But don't get me wrong, he had a lot of things he could access at Hibs to help him get to where he is. And obviously, like, man of the match performance every week for Villa just now. Brilliant player and great to see him doing so well.
Well, not so much when he plays against us, but yeah, I take the point. Now, when this kind of, I don't know what you call it, it's not really a marriage. I suppose it's kind of like a dalliance or a flirtation or maybe even a sort of like an illicit affair. I don't know what you call it, was announced. I think that the story broke in one of the Scottish newspapers and it wasn't a total surprise when it happened. I think probably to most Brighton fans and to most Hibs fans, there was a kind of a raising of the eyebrows slightly, as if to say, well, okay, you know, it neither pleases nor offends. It probably in both cases, each other's club is a bit of an unknown. So how did it go down amongst the Hibs fans? Was it sort of something exciting or was it just sort of, oh, right?
It's been a strange one. I mean, there's becoming a bit of a running joke about how the amount of partnerships have been announcing since the new owner came in. Like in terms of, like, you know, more financial partnerships.
We're not the only ones. You're playing away with other clubs. This is outrageous flirting.
It's been sort of like you know, like I think we've got like a razor partnership. We've got a like the Manscaped and things like that. We've got a glasses partnership, a tire partnership, a car. There's so many, like all in, out of nowhere, just trying to get different revenues of getting money through. But yeah, there was I'll double check the name, but there was an American team as well, which we've got kind of linked up with, which is I think the three of the players from there came over and had a trial with Hibs, but nothing seemed to come of that.
Right.
But yeah, and then like say this, when this one was announced for Brighton, it was kind of like, oh well, at least we're, this is, you know, big well-known Premiership club. Obviously, you know, done really well to establish themselves. You know, I don't know all this, but yeah. Establishing themselves, and that was sort of the perception, and sort of excited to see what it was. But it was kind of like, but what is it? It's kind of the only thing. It's kind of a bit vague in terms of what this partnership would fully involve.
I made a point of actually asking Paul Barber, the Albion chief executive, just before we started doing this, you know, what it's all about. I mean, his response was, it's a low-key partnership. And I think probably what they mean by that is that we're not exactly about to see green and white decking across the Amex, nor are you going to see blue and whites or seagulls across Easter Road or anything like that. I think it sounds like it's a low-key thing where the player development and the pathways, and I think there seems to be an exchange of ideas. It's basically two clubs that are not going to have this closed shop, at least to each other, in terms of, I mean, if you're talking about, you know, you've got new kids on the block coming through, then maybe there's something that the Albion can offer. And likewise, if there's players that we've got coming through and there's not appropriate, because we're sending kids out on loan all over the place, including overseas, but to send them to somewhere like Hibernian could also do sort of no end of good to them as well. So, I mean, I think it's more like, it sounds like it would be more like, okay, well, Hibs or Brighton, depends on which club you're talking about, would be the first port of call as to, it's almost so washy that it's like the two clubs haven't worked out themselves. It's just, we're going to sort of like speak to you guys ahead of speaking to anyone else. That's what seems to come across. And I was just wondering if that's something that either you've heard up there, or if it's a case of, you know, whether you think it would suit Hibernian.
It's been really tough to get a bit more sort of detail on what it's going to involve. You know, like there's been speculation running about it. Obviously, like, for example, Watford linked with Josh Doig for $4 million. There was the talk of, well, are Brighton going to have like a first refusal on players like that? Like, you know, I don't know exactly how they work, but for, you know, we've accepted the bid of $4 million. Do you want to put a bid of $4 million in as well? I don't know exactly how it would work. Sure. Or whether there's opportunity for, you know, players that maybe you guys don't see fully having a pathway in, coming to Hibs, but then there's a sell-on fee agreed with that, or whether it's players coming on loan. I don't know. It's don't get me wrong. I think there's, you know, I think both clubs, I'm sure we can get this a bit more, but I'm from a Hibs perspective, there's been a lot of changes at Brighton over the last sort of 15, 20 years from the outside looking in. You know, I remember the move to the stadium, the new owner coming in.
About the same time. It's actually 12 years ago this week that Tony took over.
So the new owner coming in, obviously the change in manager, which was a bit controversial at the time because a lot of people said, well, Hughton's doing his job, but obviously going for Gary Potter, which has definitely paid off. I think there's sort of, you know, an owner that definitely has a vision for the club, which is definitely what seems to be in line with Hibs, and that's maybe why there's been some sort of partnership that's been so easy to come together here.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it sounds like. So I'm not sure if there's going to be a friendly arranged or anything like that soon. That would be a kind of interesting thing. But I was just wondering if there's any kind of take up with Hibs as to sort of taking in an extra interest in the Albion, or, you know, I mean, there's people talking here saying, okay, well, you know, if you're going to choose a club from a different country that you choose to support, you know, it is boring choosing Real Madrid and Barcelona. It is boring choosing Bayern Munich or Dortmund, or you know, and it is boring choosing Celtic or Rangers. So, you know, maybe you might actually find some small uptake in some Brighton fans having a Hibs as their club. But talking of the big two, I mean, that must be something that, I mean, you finished third in the table this season, haven't you?
Yeah, third in the season. It's something that the size of club Hibs are, we should be doing a lot more often. But it's the first time we've done it in 15 years, which is actually quite bad. It's kind of, but there has been changes in the club in the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years to kind of make sure this happens on a lot more regular basis. And hopefully this is just the start of it. But yeah, finished third this season. A lot more, I think the most away wins we've ever had in a season, which is encouraging. Maybe COVID something to do that as well. But with no fans. But yeah, it's been steps in the right direction anyway.
Okay, gun to head here. I mean, I don't know how you would judge it, but gun to head here. Would you call Hibs the third largest club in Scotland, or you know, would you give that mantle to someone else?
If any other Hibs fan asks me, then yes. But honestly, I think you know, Aberdeen have had, you know, in recent years they've been finishing third for a long time, and kind of deserved that mantle. And obviously they've got the past of winning the European Cup or the UEFA Cup, whatever it is now, and the European Super Cup. So, you know, they've got those two European Cups. A long time ago, yeah. But, you know, I think it'd be interesting in terms of the next, how going forward, they've got a big rebuild to do. So it'll be interesting whether to see how quickly they can do that rebuild and sort of catch up with us, I guess. But I can hope that Hibs continue to build from where we are and get a bigger gap between ourselves and Aberdeen and continue establish yourself as, at least for the meantime, the third biggest club in Scotland.
I was about to say, I mean, we'll finish off with your hopes for the cup final this weekend in a sec, but what is the immediate future in your mind? What is the immediate future for Hibs? Is the path kind of up on an upward trajectory? I mean, are you in a good place looking for somewhere better, as it were?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, don't get me wrong, I know there's interest in some of our best players, but at the same time, the interest in those best players, we've got long-term contracts on, so we could definitely get money in and then reinvest that money. And in recent years, the club's been investing the money well and already started to invest that for next season. We've got a young lad, a 20-year-old from Inverness coming in who scored like 12 goals or something. So that's quite exciting, scoring 12 goals at 20-year-old from the left wing. You know, and Hibs have kind of got him in already before even the transfer window's open. So I think the aim has to be, you know, this is, if we win tomorrow, this is going to be one of the best seasons in, I don't know, 50 years or something, finishing third and winning the Scottish Cup in the same season. But winning a cup and finishing third has to be a regular occurrence, at least getting to cup finals. But, you know, that has to be the aim. And yeah, I mean, you know, Celtic and Rangers, you know, Rangers unbeaten season are not going to be easy to catch anytime soon. Celtic have got a massive rebuild, but they've got the finances behind them. Obviously, talk at Eddie Hill going in there. Don't know if he will or not. He's apparently linked with Palace as well. But, you know, they've got a big rebuild to do. They've got the finances. Ron Gordon spoke about splitting the old firm and potentially long-term challenging for the league. That seems really far off for me. But in terms of the more nearer future, I think we have to be establishing ourselves as third, getting European football on a regular basis, especially with the UEFA conference now, potential of European football until Christmas. So having, you know, that regular Wednesday night or Thursday night football would be amazing. And then, yeah, you know, winning more cups, because like I say, it took us 114 years to win the Scottish Cup, and hopefully tomorrow will be the second time in 5 years. So, yeah.
I think there's hardly a neutral fan who hasn't seen that footage of that entire end at Hampden Park. Sunshine, and you've just won the cup, and there's whatever it is, 20,000 of you belting out Sunshine on Leaf. Now, I don't suppose you're going to get the opportunity for that number tomorrow, but tell us what the cup final is going to mean to you. Tell us about your build-up, you know, the whole shebang.
Yeah, so it's definitely different, this one. There was the whole thing. It's a bit crazy. There was, like, last week they announced on the Friday morning, or Thursday evening, sorry, they announced that there was going to be 600 fans in attendance, 300 Hibs fans and 300 St Johnston fans. And then they announced on the Friday morning how they were going to divvy out those tickets. And then by Friday evening, Glasgow was announced to be in a level 3. So up in here, that's like, you can't travel out that area and can't travel into it because of COVID. So no fans could go. So it seems nuts. To me, I don't understand why the game's been played at Hampden. I'd travel down to anywhere in England because obviously England fans are back in England now. Mm-hmm. I travel anywhere to go see to see Hibs play in the final, but unfortunately no fans, which is a shame. No fantastic scenes like the Sunshine and Leith, but we're making the most of it. Obviously with the rule changes, we can kind of see friends and family, looking forward to kind of making the most of it. And my friend's got a pub in his back garden that he kind of built, we're going there and that'll be really good. Try and see some friends on Sunday, but obviously try and be sensible with the rules and stuff and not make any idiot scenes like Rangers did, if anybody's seen the news of that up here. But yeah, like I say, just trying to make the most of it. It's a bit rubbish that, you know, we can't be in more groups of friends and see more people. I know a lot of people are kind of, because of the rules, doing things outdoors, but making the most of it. But it's not going to be the same being there, but at the same time, I mean, I think Hibs deserve this cup tomorrow. No disrespect to St Johnston. Obviously, they've had a good season as well, winning the League Cup up here. But I've really enjoyed this week in terms of, you know, from a podcast point of view, getting all the extra content out. We've got a really exciting sort of, we're live tonight with a big quiz and things like that. Looking forward to that. But yeah, just it's fantastic to be in the last game of the season, the cup final. But it's just obviously not going to be as amazing as 2016 because we're not there.
Sure. Although I would say one thing, at least you've actually finished your league season before you have your cup final. We've actually completely blown that way down here for the sake of a few more quid. Gavin Wilson of Hibs Talk Podcast, thanks very much indeed for coming on to the Albion Raw. Now, since we recorded that conversation with Gavin, unfortunately for Hibernian, they lost the cup final 1-0 to St Johnstone. So our commiserations to them. But, you know, nonetheless, we look forward to keeping in touch and seeing where this cooperation deal leads. Anyway, back to Manchester City, I guess. AD.
One of my favourite, I mean, we've been talking quite a lot about the last game, the last season with Dean over the last few weeks. Yeah. One of my favourite with Dean memories was beating Man City in the League Cup just after they'd just been taken over, actually. But it wasn't the late goal by Glenn Murray, it wasn't the penalty shootout. It was the pitch invasion led by a man in a mobility scooter. That was my one of my favourite.
The thing is, you saying about what happened just before the game, in other words, Man City got taken over. Do you remember what happened to us just before that game, about 3 days earlier? We lost 1-0 to nine-man Walsall. Yes, one of the worst games I've never seen.
It was quite horrific. You had a point?
Well, I was just going to quickly link Man City and Ball Boys because... I don't know if you picked this up on the US commentary on Wednesday night. They were saying that Sanchez was shouting to the ball boy not to give him the ball back when it was a goal kick. I don't know if you picked that up.
Oh, right. And that's something I find something quite ironic, and it's actually part of the wider whole scope of everything. Because, you know, Edison took forever with his goal kicks. You know, Stuart Atwell saying, get on with it, come on, hurry up. You know, and when the tables are turned, you know, they start, I've seen one or two bits of US commentary. I saw the Chelsea game on a US commentary and they are horribly biased towards they're not even subtle about it. I mean, their entire post-match analysis, even when we scored, was from a Chelsea point of view. They're not even subtle about it, are they, John?
To be fair, you're not the first person to say that, Al, but I will stick up for them a little bit. I tweeted out, and then Paul, who runs Stateside Seagulls over here, and then the club picked this up, actually. The club retweeted this. Robbie Earle did a fantastic story about with Dean, and he talked about the Athletics Tract. He used to live half an hour, so he lived in Sussex somewhere, half an hour from the match, and they gave us a lovely story at Robbie L did the other day. But you're not the first person to say that. Yeah, I think it's just part of getting the perception that Brighton is a big club over here. I mean, the top six are still very much perceived as such in the US, as I've experienced as well. So if you're not in the top six, you're not really that known. But the brand of Brighton is growing here very well then.
Sure, brilliant. That's good to know. Okay. Andy, can we get back to the Man City game? Because let's face it, all three of us are now going to have a rant at just about every other rant that we've heard. And I include probably, you know, the nature of the American commentator, but just about everyone else. Simon, can we start with you?
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen the footage of what Graham Potter was supposed to apologise for?
Well, yeah, I assume it's the celebration when he walks towards the halfway line with sort of his fist pumping out. Yeah. A little bit. If that was it, I'd bearing in mind our fans were also in the South Stand, I didn't really see what the problem was with it. And I just find it a little bit strange that somebody can say that he's the best English manager or English coach when we roll over and die, but when we show a bit of passion and when we show a bit of energy, and we turned them over fair and square, which we did, that there's that shouting match between the management. And obviously it all seemed a bit bad taste and very disrespectful, which is so unlike Pep, really. Which
I mean, let's face it, if Chris Hughton did that, he'd get a 10-month touchline ban. I mean, that would be outrageous behaviour.
Mild compared to what Hughton did. I mean, John, that's what's come across. Are they sore losers?
Do you know what the irony, Al, is that if you think about it from a bigger perspective, the reason the first time our manager does something like that, that I've certainly seen, it's against City. It's because they should take it as a compliment. It's because it's City he got so emotional. And
it means something.
Exactly. So I know it's reverse psychology or maybe But he should, I'm not saying he should do that at the time, but on reflection, if Guardiola thinks about it, it's just because he is such an amazing manager and City is so successful. Something, I mean, I agree with Simon. I did tweet out saying everyone's our favourite English manager until they beat us, which is exactly what happens. And just a quick thing, I saw Brian Owen on the Argus this morning for, over here, a quote from him from a press conference. This is Potter. As I've proven, I'm not a robot. I'm a human being who is capable of making mistakes. Hopefully, people judge me over a 45-year life, not a one-second action. That's lovely.
Well, the thing is, if I was going to judge him for that, I'd say brilliant, mate. I mean, I was actually quite annoyed that anyone should make him feel compelled to apologise for it. I mean, if he's genuinely stepping outside his own comfort zone and didn't feel comfortable with what he did, fair enough. But from a football fan's point of view, from a football professional's point of view, what he did was insipid. And I'm not even saying in comparison to anyone else. It was, you know, it was nothing. You know, consider it, if you're going to compare it to anyone, compare it to Jose going mad, compare it to Gus going mad, compare it to Houghton going, I mean, you know, that was, I mean, it's the liveliest we've ever seen him do it. And he feels he has to apologise for it? No, Pep. Get your head out your backside, mate. How dare you actually insist that he apologises for it?
Wow. I'm prepared to forget about it. In fact, I already have. I mean, it was a big moment in the match. I mean, like 2-0 down at that point. You know, like I said, we normally... I saw the game. I was last year. And we lost 5-0. And it was, you know... when you're 1-0 down after a minute, you're kind of thinking, oh, God... you know, it's going to be a long night. But I mean, that first goal as well. I mean,
I was tempted to say bad game management.
You'll have Al to deal with on that one. I agree with you. But yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, was it poor marking? Was it just not in the game yet? Because I mean, Foden was involved in that goal as well.
And they
do move the ball so very, very quickly, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, obviously from day one when we were at the Amex and we saw them play, obviously it was a step up from the Championship and it was the Championship on fast forward. The way they move the ball is amazing and it's typical of them getting out the blocks quickly, isn't it, against us? Because they did it the last home game and they did it at Wembley as well. And we just thought, here we go again. I was at the other end, so I couldn't really see who was to blame.
That's a good point. I've forgotten how early they scored in the cup semi-final. That was about the same time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it must have been. Jesus, I think it was.
It was.
But Al, you mentioned them quick, you know, moving the ball quickly. I remember I was lucky enough when I had the season ticket to go to the first game in the Premier League against City, our first home game. And I think one of the things that, of course, I watch football all the time, but seeing them, how quickly they move the ball, I was thinking after 20 minutes, oh man, we're in for a hiding. I think we only lost 2-0 in the end. Mm-hmm. But I know some of our play this season reminds me of that day back in our first Premier League game against City at the Amex. We are now first touch, bang, 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 at the back as well, looking confident generally. And I think that's the testament to how we've moved on. We're playing really good football. That reminds me of what City have played in the past. And of course, they're still playing it, but I think the gap between the teams, evidently from Tuesday night, given 10 men, but is becoming smaller.
Well, even before the 10 men, even before, you know, I know it was only about 9 minutes into the game, but even then, all right, City scored their early goal. But, you know, we were looking on the front foot. We were closing them down already. You couldn't really judge a game on those first 10 minutes per se. But what I would say is, and this is harking back to the point you're making here, John, was that if you compare that Albion game, that Albion performance of that very first game in 2017, and how it really was men against boys, rabbits in headlights, insert your own cliche here, versus that game on Tuesday. And I do include the fact that, you know, the first 7 minutes, when the first 9 minutes before they went down to 10 men. But even then, a 10-man City, hello, it went 2-0 up. They're still good enough to take most teams apart. But it's not as though City have regressed. I don't think so. No. But you see the confidence, and at times, and this is a word I use with you, AD, the swagger with which we play and do absolutely everything except score is absolutely astonishing. And I'd say, arguably, given the level that we're playing at, probably the best we've ever seen.
Yeah. Well, I've said this before as well, and I'd like to see what you guys think about it as well, is that in his first season, he sorted out the defence, then he sorted out the midfield, and then he's going to, I think that the final piece is sorting out the top end of the pitch. Now, obviously, I mean, we've seen the likes of, I mean, Eve Bissouma, for instance, completely fly under Graham Potter and become unrecognisable from the player that started with us. And you're seeing that how solid
most players are growing, aren't they? Most players are growing.
And they're getting used to it, but it's just doing it piece by piece. And when he's doing it, he's actually doing it by revolutionised the style of play and completely reduced the average age of the squad at the same time. It's just tremendous. So it's just that final piece of the jigsaw at the top end, and we're going to be in the Champions League, boys.
Well, steady on, Simon. I mean, do you agree with that? It's basically that, you know, we are there apart from that finisher or that set of finishers.
Yeah, I think we have progressed. I think the quality of play has progressed. I think the way the club is managing their players in terms of their development going out on loan has progressed. And yeah, I mean, this season, more than any, it's been fine margins. If you look at our goal difference, we're halfway up. If you look at our clean sheets, we are in the top 10. It is that final bit, isn't it? And we've been saying it for a while. And let's face it, the difference between an average side and a quality side is normally a striker. If you look at clubs that get promoted, it's somebody knocking in the goals. And if you look at the top end, you've got all the hitters at the top end. It's difficult because where do you find them and where do you get value for money? Obviously, we've gone to around the 20 million mark with players. And I guess you either go foreign or you get championship players for that sort of money. But yeah, no, it's the only bit that's left in our game that I think needs sorting.
But John, it does take the others as well, the other midfielders and the wingers and everyone else. It takes for them to step up and score as well, shouldn't it?
Yeah, no, definitely. And you know, it's not just our strikers. I mean, Bissouma has been absolutely superb. The way that he recovers, the way he tackles, the way he gets about the pitch. But his final third game needs improving.
Yes.
And I think he would openly admit that. Trossard, he is probably the most talented footballer we've got, but his application, it goes in and out of games all the time. So he needs to step up. Mopay's lost confidence. I people laugh at me because I'm a fan of Mopay and he's worked what he does for the club, but you can tell that he is lacking confidence in front of goal, which is a shame because, you know, at the level below, he was scoring for fun. Yeah. So yeah, it's one of those things that just needs sorting, and it's hard to do. Everyone knows that in football. Hard, you know, the hardest thing to do is to score a goal.
Yeah.
But yeah, everything else is there. Everything else is there. The pattern of play, the consistency of performances are there.
Yeah, John. I mean, next week we're going to find out just how ridiculously wrong our pre-season predictions were. But one of mine was that we're going to have three players in double figures this season, and from the amount of chances we've had and the chances that we've missed, we should have done, really, shouldn't we?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I may have mentioned last time you kindly invited me on the XG figures about the opportunities we've created. Opportunities. I'm actually a Simon, you alluded to Mopay there. I'm a fan of his as well. I think he's an extremely intelligent player. And as people have pointed out, he does a lot behind the scenes or away from, you know, just shooting in terms of build-up play. But yes, of course, we should be... Well, it's scary. I know you're joking. And of course, Champions League is silly to say. But it's a rhetorical question. But lots of people are saying it. Where would we be if we could have scored? I mean, if we could have finished, you know, it's an incredible, it gives you real positivity for the future. But as Simon alluded to, getting hold of someone who's going to score 20, 25, 30 goals is, you know, you just can't pick them off trees. And in terms of what you said earlier, Al, about midfielders as well. Yes, we talked about psychologically a sort of thought going through the team unconsciously. I can tell you certainly from my experience, when as Simon alluded to, when Bissouma comes back and makes a tackle or White does the same thing, and there's energy, that spreads like a virus, a positive virus that spreads through the team. So like the same as a goal lifts a team, a great performance, a great tackle, seeing your fellow players really put their all in, it lifts the group completely.
Those last ditch tackles. I mean, I've got one written down here. I mean, I've got White v Foden, round one, a brilliant tackle with Foden about to pull the trigger, which was in the first half, where he timed his tackle, but he's pretty much on the penalty spot actually, and he timed his tackle to absolute perfection, and it was brilliant. Unfortunately, he got completely undone by Foden. On let's face it, we can criticise the players all we want, but let's just give Foden a little bit of love on this one, because it was absolutely...
It was a great goal until he celebrated it.
A brilliant goal. We'll get completely lost because they lost.
Yeah,
he must be fast because Ben White was chasing him and he couldn't catch up, could he?
No. So let's talk about, in that case, Albion's three goals. We're 2-0 down. We're up against it, staring both barrels. We still think that, at the time, Man City are... You know, this behemoth, this sort of beast that's there to be beaten, and you can't do it. You know, you're flailing away with slings and arrows, and it's not coming down. And then 2 minutes later, lovely assist from Rodri for Leandro Trossard.
Eventually,
how many people are saying, for whatever's sake, stick the ball in the goal? Who was going mad here, Simon?
Yeah, I mean, we were saying, shoot. And he just kept delaying. They kept falling over. And then they go around another one. And then what a strike. It was great when it went in, because it was right in line with my eye. So he went right across the face of the box, didn't he? And as he shot, he was really in line with himself. So what a great feeling. It was a great goal and a great time to come back into the game after they had probably thought they killed the game off.
Yeah, I was just waiting for it to hit the post.
Yeah. John, what happened to the cat at that moment?
Oh, the cat was outside, luckily. oh, yeah. I funny enough, I was watching last night the replay just with a glass of wine, trying to relive the emotions. And I kept an eye on, is it Rodriguez, Al, did you say?
Rodri Hernandez.
Yeah. He it's really interesting if you get on replay to watch him. He knows straight away. He doesn't move. He looks at the sky with his arms in the air, and then incredibly from the rear, behind the goal, when you see Trossard coming towards you, you just stare at him, and then he almost goes on his knees when he scores. And that was the start, wasn't it? I mean,
absolutely.
It was 3 minutes after their goal. I looked at it, 2.5 minutes or 3 minutes after their goal. So hugely important time to score.
Yeah. And I mentioned it in the intro there, but I mean... the Amex is going to need a new roof after that, because, I mean, 8,000 people in that stadium, the capacity of Withdean, my God, those people, desperate to be there, wanted to be there, and they put absolutely everything behind the side that day.
I think it was the 8,000 who make the most noise anyway, because I couldn't tell the difference between that and a 30,000 crowd. I mean, you heard the... I watched the match, the whole match, or the very extended highlights on BT Sports 3 the next morning. And, you know, they were forever going on about the noise of the crowd. And it's almost as if they would say, this is unfair against Manchester City. Well, Yahoo sucks. Sorry. They've got a stadium twice the size of ours. You know, this poor old, you know, bereft little Manchester City, poor little victims of Manchester. Sorry, it's the way the cookie crumbles. We happen to be playing at home.
Yeah.
And as we've said, there's no way that the crowd didn't lift them. I mean, it's like you almost suck the ball into the net from Webster's header.
Okay. I'm going to play devil's advocate here, though, boys. It's
why?
Basically, we're playing Manchester City. Let's face it, most people were just delighted to be there and to be back in the stadium. We probably weren't expecting to get an awful lot out of the game. If the coins had fallen that we were playing Burnley in that game and we went 2-0 down, I think the reaction would have been very, very different from the crowd.
It's a tough one. Alan, last time I was on in January, you said this. You said it's going to be very emotional when we've got fans back in the stadium. Now, I'm assuming you're alluding to 30 rather than 8, and we could not have possibly imagined that a 25% full Amex would have created what we had. this week. I mean, but I think it goes back, sorry, to psychology. When something's taken away from you, you want it even more. And you might quite be right, AD. Burnley, Man City, Spurs, who knows how the different reactions would have been.
Yeah.
But when something's taken away from you, and going back to social society that Al alluded to earlier on, people got to be together to feel part of something, to hug, to sing. That was, I don't know, AD. I think people's ability to be together again would have overridden any club we were playing on Wednesday night.
It's unquantifiable. You cannot put a value against it. You cannot put a measure against it. It's the human emotion, and it's that missing link, that gap that you cannot actually put into words. You can't put into, you can only feel it. You can't even explain the emotion. It's that missing link that sets apart probably football from so many other parts of society.
But just to give it as a comparison, and I think this is absolutely horrific what Spurs did. I mean, they hid all their fans away in the top tiers like a dirty little secret. And quite rightly, the team got pouters during that game because they didn't perform very well. But it was, you know, but for them, it was exactly the same situation. It was their first game back. Admittedly, they were put up right in the foot. They needed binoculars, frankly.
AD?
Yeah.
Don't care. Really don't care.
That's what I thought.
Siri's had a word with you.
Okay, so sorry, right, let's move on. Simon, second goal. You must have just gone a little bit more than yep.
Yeah, it was that felt like, because how many goals this season in open play, a cross come in and we score with a rocket header? Not enough, definitely. And it just felt like the momentum of the game had changed, and obviously the atmosphere was great. It just felt like a Goldstone moment, that goal, because I can remember so many goals like that at the Goldstone, just where it was going in, and what a header.
I think that might have been our first headed goal from open play this season, actually.
I honestly don't know, but it doesn't happen, does it, very often?
It was a terrific ball from Pascal as well, which was his eighth assist of the season, matching last year's, I think. And he is the assist king, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the guy defies logic, you know, in terms of he isn't the paciest, but he finds space, and his delivery is as good as anyone that we've ever had in our club in terms of creation and kicking the football.
OK, we've got to move on. So let's get on to the winner. Just about the biggest Bambi on ice, clumsiest goal you've ever seen. Now, before I get to you, John, to describe how you felt at the time, I would say that I was in the West Stand upper, but level with the penalty area. And I know there was people around me thinking, oh my God, was that offside? But being level with it, I was so confident it wasn't. So, John, Dan Byrne, okay, have a go at this. Describe his goal.
Bambi on ice with a left foot. Keeper palms it out to Bambi on ice on the right foot. He scuffs it, hits the ground first. Bobbles into the bottom left-hand corner. Ballistic scenes.
And he doesn't even get up to celebrate it, does he?
No, he just lies there. I mean, what I do on Twitter, it means that I generally, unfortunately, just take away from the game to some degree because I'm trying to do quick rhymes and I do two-liners, three-liners every few minutes, I try. But honestly, it wasn't that prevented me screaming as much as I would do. It was the worry already, the unconscious knowledge that there was still quite a lot of time left. Yeah. And I just couldn't already visualise us losing or losing, even becoming 3-3. I just was terrified. I did not celebrate until the final whistle.
I think especially with once we got, I think it was a case that we'd gone ahead and immediately, almost, you know, 50 seconds later, City had a free kick on the edge of the box. Lallana had and the whole of the Amex went quiet, and you could hear everyone thinking the same thing. Whoops.
Yeah.
Well, we had Big Bad Bob there to like protect us, didn't we? And like, yeah, you know, it was a bit unorthodox. But I mean, I just want to rewind a little bit to one of the most joyous things I've seen this season, which was the sight of Adam Webster after scoring his first goal of the season and his first goal at the Amex, completely going completely mental, running the touchline like Glenn Murray at Birmingham. It was
no one keeping up to celebrate.
And he was just like giving it, and it was the sheer utter delight on his face was just it was wonderful.
You do get the feeling from everything that we've read on social media since that game. You do get the feeling, and it's we know how we feel, and we're trying to elucidate it on this show, and others have been doing it on their show and what have you. We, you know, it's one of those where we could go to the pub afterwards and sit there with a happy smile, and the beer could be off, and we'd still enjoy it. But you also get you can also see, and this is something that it's fairly rare. You could see what it meant to the players as well.
Yeah, it was just an old fashioned Brighton and Hove Albion moment, and whatever we said about the season, we haven't had that comeback spirit until that day, and I just think it was an iconic moment in terms of us knowing that we can turn around a game against quality opposition like Man City, albeit depleted Man City.
I would caveat with that the fact with we came back from 3-0 down against Wolves, which
well, no, it was 3-1 down we were,
and no, it was 3-0.
No, we scored first that game. Promise you, we scored first.
3-1 at half time.
It was 3-1 at half time.
But we actually we had a goal wrongly ruled out by VAR.
For being Dan Byrne or something.
Well, no, it was Trossard scored, and basically the ref blew his whistle too early. He should have waited for it to go to VAR because it was no.
Oh,
foul.
Yes, I remember.
And
yeah.
But then they
missed the sitter in the last minute as well. But no, it was.
We should also
obviously this is massive, but winning games like against Man City, having the fans back in and everything is fine, but we still got another game to go. We go to Arsenal this weekend, last game of the season. For everyone at home, I'd like you to react like it is the last game of the season. I want to see pictures of you in Hawaiian shirts. I want to see pictures of you in fancy dress. I saw some wonderful pictures of our trip to Notts County game of the game, where Vicky was dressed as the Queen, and one of our friends, I'm not going to name his name, but when you're walking around Nottingham dressed as Margaret Thatcher, it's not going to go down very well. Come on, let's see your pictures of your fancy dress. Last game of the season, we're staying up. Record fifth season in the Premier League.
Well, now hang on a minute, AD. I think you're actually sort of you're underplaying this one a little bit with the too much fun. There is actually genuinely something to play for here.
We can still finish above Palace. Absolutely. They lose to Liverpool, we win. We finish above them as well. So there is a lot to play for. And and as John's alluding to there, every single place in the Premier League is worth an extra £3 million. So it's, you know, and in the COVID hit year where we haven't had the flip of the burger, we haven't had the click of the turnstiles, every little bit of money we can get back into the club matters massively. Okay, so Simon, you've had a massive success with your book, From the Gutters to the Stars. Only a few copies left, I understand.
Exactly that, yeah. I mean, when I last was here, we were just launching it. I said I'd love to raise £3,000 for charity. Well, it's gone above and beyond, and what a generous community our Albion fans are. Worldwide, it's gone out across Europe, it's gone out to the States, it's gone out to Australia. It just beggars belief. So we are now in a situation where we've almost taken £10,000, of which 5 plus gift aid will be going to Macmillan. And we haven't finished yet. So there are a few copies available. It's been an amazing experience, an absolutely amazing experience. People talking to me about their passion, their stories. I've had people coming in lockdown with masks. I've had people, you know, just coming and telling me that their life stories about the Albion. And it's been amazing because there's certain things that I know, but there's a lot I don't know. And to hear that from the community has been brilliant. And the support and just the endearment of Brighton fans is, well, we know it already. We've got one of the best set in the world. And as Jonathan has already alluded to, it's getting wider and wider. And, you know, it's just gone mega in terms of Australia, Hawaii. I can't believe it.
Simon, for those who didn't hear your last appearance on the show or been living under a rock, can you just remind us what the book is all about?
Yeah, the book is about Brighton going from the Withdean in our uprising to the period until such time as Chris Hughton left the club. It's about following a football club more than the football club itself. But it's about the passion, it's about the support, but it's entwined with some personal stuff as well, because during that period, my mum was ill with cancer, my wife got seriously ill with cancer as well, and my sister, just as I was finishing the book, was diagnosed with cancer. So I entwined all of my Albion experiences from that period with my personal thoughts, and it's basically played on people's heartstrings in some ways. And I think certain people, it's helped them. There's certain guys that have been going through, who thanked me and said some of the advice you've given has helped. So it's a win-win. It's just been brilliant.
And it is a great book. And for those who for the last few copies, if you would like to get hold of one, how do they do that?
They just simply email me a good old-fashioned address called simon-jane@tiscali.co.uk.
Now, for those other of you who are on the Twitter sphere or on social media, you may have noticed a chap called the Brighton Bard popping up with some fine like lines of verse. And Simon, it's been going really well for you, isn't it? And apparently you've had to open various other social media accounts to keep up.
It's been great fun. As I said before, it's a real selfish thing in one way. I moved over here full-time 6 months ago, and I started doing poems the year before that, just to stay in touch. It's been great fun. I've enjoyed interacting with you guys on here. I know you're big on Twitter, it's great to keep me in touch with the city, the club and the county.
I mean, that was the question I was going to ask. I mean, do you feel through what you've been doing, you've probably got a bigger following than you would have had if you're still here?
Well, probably 100%, because I've changed it slightly, AD, to also say it's about me sharing my experience in Oklahoma. There's not many Brits over here. Route 66 is an interesting place. My wife's family have a big ranch in the Panhandle. So, you know, I'm also trying to give back by saying this is what it's like to be in America. Hasn't got the best press at the moment, this country, for some reason. I think my experience has been amazing, and it's a friendly place. Everybody I've met is so friendly, and I wanted to share that as well.
We joked last time you were on about Route 66 and being how fast to get to Tulsa, how long does it take there, and it is a fabulous experience for you. I take it you're going to be there permanently now. You're not thinking of coming back at any point?
No, I mean, one of the big things is healthcare over here, as you're probably aware. My wife has a full-time job, so we do have health insurance, but we've certainly talked. Even already, before we even settled down here, we said, you know, maybe longer term, the UK would be a better place. And if it's the UK, it's going to be Sussex. But no, I'm turned 50 next year, so I've still got a few years in me, I think. And we'll be here for at least a decade, I would have thought. My wife's job is looking solid, which is lucky. I've closed my business in the UK, down opened over here. So my roots are here. So I'm looking forward to sharing more American adventures as well as a few poems about Brighton online.
Yeah, you want to get back to the Amex though, don't you?
Oh, mate, I'm trying to... There was talk on the media that the US may become a place from which you don't have to isolate if you're fully vaccinated. Now, I've had both jabs, so I'm... By the way, it was brilliant over here. It didn't cost me a penny and was done within 4 weeks, both jabs. Very, very good service. I was hoping that might allow me to come back earlier, but with the Indian variant... It's going to be a while till I'm at the Amex. I mean, obviously it'll be next season now, but it may be next calendar year as well, by the looks of it.
Now, John, I don't know if it's true or not, but did you say that you've actually penned a few lines of prose for us for this show? If you have, oh, love to hear it.
ADNL sent me a message from the Albion Roar. It said, "Fancy coming on the show?" I responded, "I'd love to, but my head's still sore." Yes, to be quite honest, after a momentous week, a cool, dark room with a bed is probably what I should seek. But I'm still on a high, like we all are. And for the last few days, a glass of wine has never been far. I've not enjoyed the resulting foggy head, but I did enjoy seeing Graham beat Pep, and then Pep seemingly wet his bed. The best result at the Amex? Certainly, without a doubt. Made even better with the emotion of seeing 8,000 fans hug, sing, and shout. Twitter went into a positive meltdown for once. It was a sight to behold. Tears flowed and wouldn't stop. Emotions uncontrolled. Last time I was lucky enough to be asked on, for some fans, the Potter jury was still out. I say the same now as then. These people seemingly don't know what our football club's about. A fifth year in the Premier League, potentially a highest point score. I'm predicting our best season ever next year. And for the 17th year, it will be all covered on the Albion Roar.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you, John. That is so kind. What lovely words. Thank you.
I think that's all we've got time for. So, of course, thank you to Simon Medhurst. Thank you to Jonathan Bradshaw. Thank you to Alan Wares. Thank you to Gavin Wilson from Headstalk. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com on DAB, and, of course, on our podcast at in association with oldfootballshirts.com. We'll see you again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye. You saw it, you claimed it, you touched it.